The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Well, welcome back, everyone, to the second half, the afternoon part of our fourth annual International Right to Know Day program. And as I indicated this morning in the brief introduction, we have something very special for the first panel today because it focuses entirely on one particular part of the international transparency landscape, and that is a major development that should have considerable impact worldwide at the World Bank. Most particularly that the World Bank, as of July 1, has established a new transparency program or regime, whatever is the correct word, and it's something that will have wide-reaching impact both within the World Bank structure for the records of that organization, but also will position, I think it's fair to say, the World Bank to, in time, take a greater role in leadership with respect to international transparency. And I'm getting a little bit ahead of things in time that way, but that's part of what we talked about this morning with President Obama, also suggesting that the U.S. would finally now be able to reclaim its role and restore its position of leadership in the international transparency community. And I'm pleased that we have with us, first and foremost, this afternoon, Ms. Anne-Marie Lubois, who is the General Counsel, Vice President General Counsel of the World Bank. As I mentioned this morning, we have biographical information in the separate bio handout that all of you received, so I won't spend much time at all going into biographical information on the speakers. We'd rather devote that time to the substance of what the speakers have to say. But I would also say by way of handouts that we have copies of the new transparency policy that the World Bank has as part of your handout package, and also press releases and the like. And that's something that you therefore have a lot of information about right there. Our next speaker, or panelist I should say, because we're hoping to have nice dialogue on the panel, is Chad Dobson of the BIC, I'm told it's for short, the Bank Information Center. And Chad goes back many, many years with that, and then left and then came back. And now that's a CSO, if that's the correct term, that is very active in that area of things. And, you know, if you'll allow me a personal observation, back in the day, and I guess I do go back a ways to the 70s, we used to talk about public interest groups, and that was a pretty commonly understood term. Groups that looked out for the public interest. They didn't exist very much until Ralph Nader started his Nader's Raiders back in the late 60s, early 70s, but that's the term that was used. Then there was another term, a sort of successor term, if you will, that was largely, I think, imported from overseas, NGOs or non-government organizations. And that term became very commonly used. But now, lately, I think it's fair to say that there's a trend, at least in this area of international transparency, of talking about CSOs, civil society organizations. So I think it's fair to say that the BIC is a CSO. Okay? LMNRP, absolutely, you bet. And then our final panelist, who needs no further introduction from this morning, is Laura Newman, who is still catching up on sleep, as am I, or trying to stay awake because, as I say, she arrived here from Atlanta about the same time I arrived from Texas very early this morning, and you've already heard that she has much to offer in this area as well. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to shift down to be at the table, and we'll just do this at the panel table. And as I do that, you can be wherever you prefer. I'll turn you over to Ms. Leroy if you prefer to be at the podium, certainly, if you prefer to be
maybe
here.
Maybe it's easier to hear me if I'm at the podium.
Absolutely. What, okay. It should be whatever you prefer.
All right.
Good afternoon, and thank you to Professor Metcalf for inviting me to this session. Very happy to be here at American University, and let me first congratulate the students who have taken the time to improve their information on this very important type of policy for very important and developing very fast actually in many countries at present. Let me also acknowledge the presence of several World Bank people and colleagues. Very happy to see them here. I would like to I'll be brief. I won't go into too much details about the policy because you can find all that on the World Bank website, where there is a dedicated website on the access to information policy. But let me give you the key points, and then we can have a discussion. Why the World Bank actually completely changed its access to information policy on July 1st this year, shifting from a system, very classical system, where the baseline is that nothing is disclosable except what is on a positive list of subjects or items or papers. And we shifted completely away from that by declaring that as of now, as of July 1st, everything is accessible except a negative list, which is completely different because, of course, that opens a very, very large, a huge, actually, number of documents that were previously not disclosable. Why did we do that? We did that because we are a development institution and because we are a public institution. And also because we're interested in improving the confidence that the financial markets have in our institution, because we borrow on the financial markets and we need that financing to finance our loans to developing countries. As a development institution, we need to improve, we need to be transparent about our projects and programs in order to improve our efficiency, because more information on our projects and program is likely to enhance the ownership of our projects by the beneficiaries and by the member countries and by all stakeholders, including people who are affected by our projects, who are concerned by our projects. As a public institution, we are accountable to our member countries and to the public at large for what we do with the resources that are provided to us. And we're also, the bank is also a knowledge institution. The bank has a wealth of knowledge, and sharing it with the rest of the world whenever that information is disclosable is part of our contribution to the development and to the global knowledge at large. So these are the main reasons. The financial markets also need to have access to more information about us, and that improves their trust in our statements and in the strengths of our financial situation. Now, the bank's new access to information policy was developed in a very consultative manner, in close consultation with a number of CSOs, and I think that Chad can testify to that, since the Bank Information Center has been closely involved and has been one of the major contributors to our thinking on this policy, and let me acknowledge their that contribution here. The end result is the most progressive access to information policy amongst international financial institutions. We are, in fact, paving the way probably for other IFIs that will follow, and I know that many of them are already closely looking at our policy and striving to follow that path as well. It's in fact part of a broader agenda for the bank. It's not only making information accessible, it's also proactively providing more information. We have put on the web, and we are disclosing more documents than ever. And our website is probably one of the richest available at present. And as I speak, we keep placing documents on the web. It's an enormous wealth of information that is available there. The key features, as I mentioned, are, by the way, this is the World Bank, but this is also the World Bank Group, which means that it also concerns the International Finance Corporation and MIGA, which are two branches of the World Bank Group as well. It's a fundamental shift, as I mentioned. It's disclosure of more information than ever before. And even when some information is restricted for access, some, for instance, deliberative information, we do have a policy that will allow for disclosure after a number of years, 5, 10, 20 years, depending on the type of information concerned. Let me just mention briefly the list of exceptions. Personal information, of course, especially nominative information, but that also includes emails that the staff exchange within the course of their day-to-day work. The communication of executive directors' offices, that was necessary because those offices are board members, World Bank board members, but they are also representatives of their own countries, and they do have communications between themselves and also between them and their countries of origin and their governments. And this is information that hardly, in a way, belongs to the bank. Information covered by the attorney-client privilege. Information that relates to security and safety issues both for the World Bank buildings, for individual staff members, for our clients, etc. Information that is covered by other disclosure regimes. Within the galaxy of the World Bank, you will find a small number of independent entities such as the Independent Evaluation Group, the Inspection Panel. These entities report only to the board, and they have their own disclosure policy. We have a specific case, which is the Office of Institutional Integrity, which investigates cases of corruption involving bank projects. Of course, a lot of these investigations are, at least at the investigation stage, confidential, and INT has just elaborated its own in access to information policy, or is finalizing it. We're also not disclosing information that was given to us in confidence and expressly stated so. We are not disclosing what we call corporate administrative information. This is, I will acknowledge that, a broad category which will be refined probably over time, but which protects some information that the bank needs to keep confidential, some of it being related to safety, others being related to financial information. There's a lot under that, but we, at this stage, we are not ready to disclose that category. Finally, we are not disclosing deliberative information. That is a very important category. And there has been a lot of debate around this. But we do believe that we need to protect the openness of the exchanges while we are deliberating on our policies or on our project. Our internal debates have to remain open and easy and frank, and making this deliberative information available would probably endanger that openness of the discussion. As you know, access to information policy is also a trade-off that has to be made, and we are trying to strike a balance here. Of course, also is not disclosable part of the financial information, such as the forecast analysis, our transactions, and banking and billing information, which is by nature confidential. But beyond those, With those exceptions, all the rest is disclosable and accessible. The policy, and it is also a novelty, introduces an appeals mechanism. The former policy had, as I mentioned, a positive list, but a decision of the bank to refuse to disclose or to deny your request would not be appealable. Now, it will be appealable, and we have, in fact, a two-tier mechanism, one which is to an access to information committee, which is internal to management, and another one to an independent body composed of three specialists, high world-class specialists in this area, one of them being Mr. Metcalf, who has graciously accepted to participate in this committee or appeals council.
Board, I think.
Yeah, appeals
we'll
board.
Get board.
Well, we still need to find the final name for the appeals committee.
I think I've been calling it the Access to Information Appeals Board.
Appeals
or in
board.
True Washington acronym type fashion, the AIAB.
AIAB.
We
Thank
are board,
you.
But we will try not to become board, that's for sure.
The other members of the board are Mr. Habibullah, Dr. Habibullah, who is a renowned access to information official. In fact, he was in charge of that policy in India. And Olivier Schrammeck, who is also very renowned. He's a judge with the Supreme Administrative Court in France. And he's been the Secretary General of the Constitutional Court in that country, and a human rights and civil liberties specialist. The appeals board members are appointed for 2 years, beginning July 2010, and we're expecting them to meet soon for their first induction meeting and then to examine their first cases. It's not going to be easy to implement. Where the bank has allowed some significant resources to do that, not only because there is this paradigm shift and we need to increase awareness of the staff on that new accessibility, but also because we need to have our administrative and IT systems ready in order to retrieve the documents that will be requested from us. And that is no small job, believe me. We do hope that the new policy will spur analysis, research, debate in a number of development areas. That's one of the outcomes that we hope will result of the process. Right now, we've had a clear increase in the number of requests since July 1st. We've had a number of appeals to the first tier, the Access to Information Committee. Not many so far, but in part because the first request that we've had, and when we had requests regarding documents that were not normally accessible, we've had a very liberal policy. The policy authorizes us to make exceptions to the exceptions, if I may say so, which is to decide that even if a document is normally not disclosable, the bank retains the authority to decide that it is the interest of the bank or it does more good than harm to disclose it. To the contrary, by the way, when a document is normally disclosable, we still retain the authority not to disclose it. If it is likely to do more harm than good to disclose it. We've not exercised a second right yet, but we do have exercised the first one already, and I believe that, and Lisa, who is here, may call me wrong if I'm mistaken, but I believe that in half the cases where we've had requests that fell outside the access to information policy, we actually accepted to disclose the documents. So we've had so far a fairly liberal approach, which explains why we don't have a lot of appeals so far. Let me just quote my president, who said on April 14, 2010, by opening the shades for others to see what we are doing, how we are doing it, and with what results, we will catch errors more quickly and improve faster. And I believe that is what we are, this is the ultimate goal here. Whatever the bank does has one ultimate objective, which is to foster development and growth in our member countries. And the access to information policy is ultimately meant to achieve, to contribute to that achievement as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Roubaix. And next we'll hear from one of our two CSO representatives, Chad Dobson from the Bank Information Center.
Thanks, Professor Metcalf, and it's nice to be on a panel with Anne-Marie and our old friend Laura. My young friend Laura, I think she's going to say. It's nice to see some students here, although it looks to me like half the audience is from the bank. It's nice to always see the bank here. And also our friend from the Inter-American Development Bank. It could be that the other banks are here as well. Let me say a couple of words about the Bank Information Center first, just to clear who we are, because it's not uncommon that I come away from these things and then at some place people say, how long have you been working at the World Bank? Because there's, you know, and Jim.
Quite a while.
Yeah, quite a while, exactly. we were established in 87, and in fact, this information policy is the fourth that I've actually paid attention to at the institution. It's a small organization, primarily American-based organization. Actually, I'm looking for my board chair who teaches here at American University, but you know, obviously at the law school, but he's not here, David Hunter.
That's David Hunter, you'd say? Professor Hunter, yes.
Yeah.
Professor Hunter is committed
not here.
He's committed to so many obligations and activities that no one has ever seen him at a single place at a single time. So that's perhaps why he's...
Exactly.
He might be here just sort of invisibly.
Exactly. Exactly. And I'll tell you a story a little bit about BIC from the beginning was, and Jim Adams, who's the VP for the Asia region, tells a story that when he was the VP in operations, that people called and complained about our name. But when we started this in 87, actually the bank, I don't believe, actually had an information policy at the time. It actually certainly didn't have info shops or any of those kinds of things. And so, in fact, the way we got information, you know, it used to arrive, I think, anonymously from bank staff who were very upset about things, who would drop envelopes at our door that were unmarked. And this is the way we got information, you know, about what was going on and passed along. It's changed a great deal since then. And I'd commend the bank on the policy it has. I absolutely agree with Anne-Marie. It is the preeminent policy, actually, for a multilateral institution in the world today, including the UN system. And when I was, a number of years ago when I was at BIC, we wrote the UNDP's information policy, and so, which isn't in fact operational now, and in fact I'd argue that most of the UN does not in fact have information policies, and the ones that they do have are not functional. So, and part of that reason is, at least looking at UNDP, was it never had a budget. So the first thing that I always pay attention to on these things is, you know, where is the budget? What does the budget line look like? Because it's fine to have the policy there, but if there's no budget, it doesn't make any difference. And I'll tell a story that's maybe one out of school, and you can smack me if I do it, but we had a discussion when the policy was being developed about because BIC and others were calling for an implementation procedure to go to the board at the same time the policy went. And we held to the notion that we really needed to have that and the budget that went along with it to see what was going to happen. And our friends at the bank said that they thought that was bad strategy because if it was ever really clear what the cost would be, it would be harder to get it through the board. And I think that the reality is that when you look at the policy, what the bank has set out here really is a phenomenal kind of piece of work. It is transformational for the institution. It goes from a place where, you know, most things were off the record and a few things were on, to a place where now the presumption is that everything should be available with some exceptions. And if you're operating in 160-plus countries and in multiple languages, this is a very big piece of work, and it's very difficult. But it is really, I think, the challenge for development, and that's why we say, you know, that poverty alleviation and development is rocket science, and it's the most difficult thing in the world. And we commend the bank for taking the risk to do something like this. And it's our job, I think, you know, I think there's some concern that with a policy as far-reaching as this, that it would be very easy to point out failures, because there will be significant failures over the time about implementation of policy. But I think it behooves all of us to make sure that the policy works and to find ways to work with institutions and within our own organizations in the South and in the North to make sure we find ways to get over the problems and get to a place where these things work. Anyway. So Anne-Marie mentioned it, but let me quote from the beginning of the policy, because even though you have it in the front, you know, out there, you know, you may not have read it for the test, so I want to make sure you...
Some of my students are here, I should point out, and in the case of many of them, I think it already is committed to memory.
No,
they're very quick like that, but for the rest of the audience, I think you're correct.
Right. Well, I would argue that the first paragraph, the introduction, is in fact the key to the material. And for all of you lawyers who are going to the footnotes and other things, what you really need to do is need to be aware of what the premise of the new policy is and why it's important. And I raise it now because I think it raises attention within the institution itself later on that thankfully Anne-Marie is going to have the chance to manage and address. But the two sentences I would note here, it says, the bank recognizes transparency and accountability are fundamental importance to the development process and to achieving its mission to alleviate poverty. Okay. Transparency is essential. It's critical for enhancing good governance and development effectiveness. Openness promotes engagement with stakeholders, which in turn improves the design and implementation of projects, policies, and strengthen outcome. And I would argue that's the most important. And then if you go to the second page, it is outlined very clearly the five principles of the policy. And the first one, of course, is maximizing access to information, clear list of exceptions, safeguarding of deliberative process, and providing clear procedures for making information available, and then registering requesters' right to appeal. But I think that I think it's well written. I think it sets things out clearly, and I think that it's important. Now, let me suggest a couple of challenges besides the fact that any institution that has as much information that the bank does, even to just get it up on its website and make it available in the multiple languages and to all other people, is important. But one of the key things is that if you're looking to alleviate, you know, or minimize poverty and do development, it means that you're really at some point going to have to get to the people who are most involved. And what we're dealing with here is a process that is at this point still where much of the information happens electronically and in forms that are not really available at the local level. And this is not a critique. It's just paying attention to what is really the situation is. How do you get the information actually down to the people who are most affected by what the bank and development institutions are doing? So, and that goes to, of course, the question of budget and other kinds of things. One of the things that I've noted, the second part of this is going to be a real challenge, I think, is the change in staff, or the training of staff in order for them to realize the difference in these two information policies. As you may remember from your Bible reading in the Old Testament, the Lord told Moses that the people weren't able to go into the new land, and they were going to tarry in the wilderness for 40 years until the old people had died. And it was because they didn't want to take the old people into the new place and corrupt the system. Now, I'm not suggesting people in my shop, because I'm by far the oldest person, are, I think, waiting for me to die. But I would say that The institution has, the bank has a lot of people who have been raised to do a very good job, but sometimes that is not focused on sharing information widely. And that the training and encouragement and facilitation and, you know, gentle prodding and those kinds of things of staff to move from what they've been doing for many years to the new ideas is going to be difficult, especially because almost all of these people have full plates already. You know, they've got many things to do, and this isn't necessarily the first on their list. So I would say that changing the culture of the institution and working to provide the incentives to do that is going to be key and important. And in that kind of way, I think that the role that Bob Zelick has played in this is key and important. And Anne-Marie quoted what he said, and I remember actually when it went to the board for discussion, which was, December 17th. And at the board discussion, I was surprised it was happening because Zelick announced at the time that the board was going to, at the meeting, pass the policy. And it seemed to me, from what I understood about the board, that there were a number of things that were not that had not been sorted out yet. And I think, everybody knows this better than I, and will correct me. But as I remember, what happened was that after the board approved the policy, realizing there were details that were passed out that needed to be resolved, that the president, you know, made sure that the chairs actually did come to, you know, appreciate, you know, his approach to things, and that the policy was approved. All I'm saying is that this took a remarkable bit of work from the president of the institution, and that I would argue that if it wasn't for him and that the support he'd had for the vice presidencies involved with it, the policy we have today wouldn't have taken place. So, you know, we're going to have President Zelick there for another couple of years, and then we'll have a new president. And so I think one of the challenges for the new president of the bank will be how he or she provides leadership moving forward. One of the other things that I think is a real challenge that I hope the bank can deal with here is working with its sister institutions. And it's nice to see John from the IDB here, because a number of the other banks are in the process of looking at their information policies now, including the IFC, that part of the bank, the World Bank, that lends money to the private sector. I think it's a mistake in this day and age to have different information policies for the European Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, the Asian Bank, and the African Bank, and the UN agencies that work on development. And I would say that it is an unnecessary and a kind of thing that can no longer be accepted to have these kinds of differences, because the differences are small, but they are just enough to make it difficult to work together in a harmonious way. And I think that I'm hoping that the bank can provide the leadership to working with its sister organizations to come to a place where there is at some point there is an internationally agreed standard for information across the banks and the UN system. And that's something I think we need to do now. One of the exciting things that the bank has agreed to do moving forward on this is to look at the creation of advisory groups in country made up of CSOs, NGOs, academics, bank people, to help at the country level develop and facilitate how the program goes forward. And this is an exciting thing. It may have happened before that the bank has agreed to do this across the policy, but I'm not aware of it. And so we're looking forward to working with the bank on this kind of thing. One of the things that the bank has had a long history of doing, and we expect and hope it continues to do that, is working with some countries that have not necessarily had a history of openness and transparency, especially working with civil society and others, and encouraging them to do that. The bank's had a good history of doing this in some countries, and I'm thinking of Andrew Steer's work when he was the country director in Vietnam, and also some of the work that Peter Stevens and others have done in the Asia region. but that it is a role that the bank can play, and it's a role that's played some places very successfully, and we hope to see it continue to do that. Where there is now an agreed upon by government standard of openness and accountability, we hope that the bank now moves that along and encourages it. As many of you know, there are at least in 70 countries responsibilities devolving to parliaments to approve bank projects and programs. One of the things we're doing at the annual meeting coming up is we've got a parliamentarian here from Uganda, and Uganda's a country where there has to be improvement, where projects have to be approved, talking about the problems of getting information in their own country about bank projects in their country. So one of the things I'm hoping for that we can see happen here at some point with the bank is that especially focusing on those countries where parliaments have the right to information and, in fact, the responsibility to approve projects, to making sure that in those countries there's a way, especially working with parliamentarians, to make that happen. Final thing I want to say is that I think that there is a tension within the system that we're going to see and that Anne-Marie is going to have a chance to manage. And the tension is that, you know, for a number of years, many years, at least since Bob McNamara was president of the bank, the notion was that the more money you moved through the system, the more development you had. And so that there was a tension that one of the criterias for success at an institution in your job was making sure that the money that was in your portfolio at the beginning of the fiscal year was out of it at the end of the year. And that there's been a great deal of emphasis on making sure that this happens. And that I would argue, in fact, that in a world where we have the economy that we have now and that there's an increased talk about increasing general capital increase at the bank and moving more money to the institution to move, and where there's talk about the need to have a flat budget, the notion is how do you move the money at the, you know, and get it out the door that's needed, and how does that come up against a situation as represented, I would say, by the new policy that says people have to be involved, they have a right to information, they have the right to be consulted, they have the right to engage. And these two things, I think, are in fact in tension. And I suspect that there may, in fact, be even a tension at the board level between the Part 1 countries on some of these things and the Part 2 countries around this. I think we're going to see movement towards at the institution, towards country systems and streamlining the procedures and attention to efficiency and moving things out. And I would argue that the new policy talks about efficiency in a larger kind of context, but not probably in the way that we look at it by fiscal years. It's not possible to be as efficient if you're, you know, with the 12-month cycle. And I think that it's going to be something that's going to have to be managed, because I think that many of the Part 1 countries have a certain notion about what the system should look like, and many of the Part 2 countries are feeling that the most important thing is the transfer of the resources. So it'll be an interesting, in addition to all of the other challenges here, I think that this is going to be one of them that's going to be an interesting to watch. Thank you.
Thank you, Chad. And Laura, if I remember correctly, I think you too were involved in some way in the consultation process that the bank went through, which I think something that lasted more than a year and was quite wide-ranging, leading up to the development and the adoption of the policy. Is that correct? You were involved also?
Very minimally. We were privileged to actually help sponsor one of the consultations in Peru, where we brought together people from throughout the region, and about 75 people were able to come and talk about it. But nothing like chat. No involvement like chat.
But you probably have some pretty firmly held views, nevertheless, if I had to guess.
I'll take it from there. Thank you. I actually realized that although I was honored to speak this morning, I never really explained who I work for. So maybe I should tell y'all that, again, my name is Laura Newman, and I'm the manager of our Access to Information program. And when I say our, I mean the Carter Center, which is, we call ourselves an NGO, a non-governmental organization. We're headquartered in Atlanta, Georgia, and chaired, led by former President of the United States, Jimmy Carter, and his wife, Rosalynn. And the Carter Center has been around since President Carter left office, about a year or two after he was, as he likes to say, forcibly moved into retirement. They were very young, as you, some of you are really young and don't remember them at all. But for those of you who remember the Carters, they were quite young and so wanted to still do something and wanted to be active. And so created the Carter Center. And our Access to Information initiative began over 11 years ago. And it started really as an offshoot, as part of one of our pilot projects on an anti-corruption portfolio. And really quickly, we recognized the value of access to information well beyond its fight against corruption, and very much related to the other issues that the Carter Center was working on, whether that was democracy, elections, human rights, development. We had a global development initiative at that point, conflict resolution and prevention, and our health work. And so there was an understanding of how this really underpinned all of our programming, and so this initiative began. And we've been lucky enough, again, to work in a host of countries, as well at the regional level, particularly with the OAS, the Organization of American States, as well as with the African Union, and then to work with colleagues like the World Bank. And as I say, we were able to help work with the bank on one of their consultations in the regions. And also, I guess I did speak recently at the bank to about 300 of your public information officers about some of the issues around the new policy. So I also want to add my word of congratulations to the bank and certainly for your leadership on this. I know the General Counsel's office has been really critical in moving this forward, and it can't have been easy, I'm sure. I think, again, our goal, the community at large's goal, is really to transform people's lives. And we see the importance of information to do that. And the bank has now, with this new policy, really taken the leadership role in assuring that information will help to transform people's lives. So I'd like to also congratulate you. I thought what I might do in my brief time is really focus, taking from what Ms. Leroy said, a little bit on the policy, because I still think that there's a few areas that that would benefit from some consideration and maybe some development as time goes on. And then perhaps touch on some of the implementation challenges. And really my experience, unlike Chad, who has been so focused on the international financial institutions, I bring really the experience of countries who have tried to implement similar type policies, access to information legislation, and what they've learned that might also be applicable for the bank as you move forward with your new policy. So with your permission, Dan, I'll just focus a little bit on those and then maybe a short conclusion.
Certainly.
So in looking at your policy, it certainly, as with any law, will need some kind of, if not regulation, certainly policy guidelines. No law is ever passed, whether it's something like this or from a country, that is, well, either perfect or complete. It's really the bones, and what you need is some meat on the bones. And so some areas that I think, either through guidelines or maybe as people start making requests and trying to use it, that I've got eight areas that I think might merit a little additional consideration. And the first one is really on the exemptions themselves, which every policy, every law in the world on the right of access to information has exemptions. And the exemptions are there for us as the public. There's lots of information that governments or the bank hold that is not in our best interest for people to have. On a state level, for example, we talk a lot about, for example, if there's an investigation of a crime in your community, it's in our best interest as a public for that information not to be released until after the investigation of the crime. But at some point, it is appropriate for us to hold the police accountable and make sure that they are, in fact, investigating appropriately. When drafting exemptions, I think the rule of thumb is to try to make them as narrow as possible, as specific as possible, recognizing that they can't cover every possible situation. In quickly reviewing the bank's exemptions, again, although they're much more limited than they were, there is still some breadth to them. And I think some guidelines to help particularly those who will be expected to apply these exemptions would be very helpful. Again, some of this will come out through people making appeals and decisions coming from either the internal appeals or as they move to Dan and his colleagues. One area that I was a bit surprised about as we consider exemptions is that there's no room for redaction. And generally, in a good access to information law, again, at the state level, there may be bits of a document that fall under an exemption that might not be released. But if there's parts of the document that there's no reason not to release it, it's benign, it doesn't fall under an exemption, then generally what would happen is the redaction, or you would cross out those bits that are exempt, and the rest of the document would be given out. It's rare that an entire document would fall under an exemption. And yet, in looking at your policy, I don't see a specific provision for that. I do think that, of course, there's openings to, perhaps I've missed it. Okay, I'm looking at all my bank colleagues to get their reactions as I'm doing this to make sure that I haven't misread something. Perhaps I should look at this side of the room. again, this is just areas that it's a new policy. And with any new law, it takes time to develop, and it needs regulations, it needs guidelines, it needs policy instructions, particularly for those, as I say, expected to apply it. Something that Chad actually mentioned is, actually I think both of you talked about this great proactive disclosure, which is going to be the best way in most cases to get information to people. The more information you can put out there, people don't have to make a specific request, it's just there, the better. But of course, you're working in some of the least developed places in our world. And so one of the concerns I had in reading about the ability to make requests is it almost seems like it's limited to information that's not already available on the website. So I almost read it that if I were to make a request, and let's presume I'm somebody living in Bamako, Mali, and I don't have access to an internet necessarily or the literacy to use the website, if it's already on the website, it almost appears that a bank official could say, oh, but it's there. And earlier we even heard about in Scotland, which is much more developed than certainly than Mali, about this tendency to do what they were calling data dumping, where they were just putting tons of information on websites and then telling people who wanted that information, oh, but it's already there, just go find it. Of course, that's going to be quite difficult for many, many of your users. And again, keeping in mind your own objectives, it's something that I would love for us as a community to really clarify and ensure that if somebody makes a request for information, even if it's on your website, that much as we ask governments to do, that you aid the requester in either finding it or still providing it. A couple just other things. Again, and I don't want to appear as though I'm in any way picking apart the policy because, of course, I'm as excited as all that it's there and that it's available for people to consider. And certainly there was a lot of opportunity to talk about it. So I don't expect, and I just want to be clear, that the policy will be changed. It's just areas because I know you're still in the process of trying to clarify. Just a bit of food for thought. So just a couple other things. In Section 26, there's a talk of an unsupported request. And I think this is something that we actually talked about when I was with the bank the last time, because what you make clear, much like any other law, is that people shouldn't have to give a reason for the request. I think you spoke earlier about this information really does belong to the people, the bank belongs to the people, and yet there is this mention of if it's an unsupported request, it's a reason for denial. So I'm just something that I was actually would love some just clarity on is what that means. What does it mean to support a request? And a similar little bit of a conflicting issue was under the service fees in Section 27, which spoke of the fact, and again, this is the case in almost every law in the world, that if somebody wants a hard copy or they want it in a different format than it's otherwise available, that they pay for that. But then it also talks about particular, in your section, it talks about particularly if it's a difficult request, which almost makes it appear as though there's going to be some fees for either making the request or for someone working on that request. And that would be quite contrary to what is the more modern trend of requests being free, you know, people providing the information that that's free, that you really are just paying for the hard copies. I guess the only other thing, I want to congratulate you, of course, on the public interest test. Certainly, we would encourage that to be true for all of the exemptions, but it is a great start to have a public interest test in this, and something that we hope our, as you call them, sister banks will also consider having public interest tests so that if it's in the public interest, it would be given. And finally, really, the two other areas are around oversight and appeals. And again, those to me, we always talk about making a law or drafting a law is oftentimes easier than implementing it or enforcing it. And that's where some of the oversight and appeals become so, so critical. So on the oversight, the role of the Access to Information Committee seems as though it's a bit of almost melding a quasi-judicial role as being an internal appeals mechanism. At the same time, it's being given some authority as an oversight mechanism to support both the staff but also the administration. And so as you, again, continue to develop the role of the Access to Information Committee, what you call the AI Committee, I personally can't put enough emphasis on, at least at the country level, at the state level, the importance of having that oversight body, someone who's there to ensure that the, in this case, the policy, or in a state's case, that the law is in fact being implemented, that there is somebody who's seeing how things are working, that's gathering those lessons. Wow, this works really well here, but it's not working so well there. How might we shift resources? How might we support the staff? What kind of training is necessary? What regulations? What instructions? So by melding that with a quasi-judicial role, in some ways it may take away from that committee's capacity to serve more of the oversight role. And then, again, with the appeals body, having an independent appeals board and certainly choosing these three gentlemen, I know two of the three, and I know them to be very robust in their support of access to information. So
those must be the gentlemen from France and India, right?
And I'm not talking about you, Dan.
Okay.
So I really, again, congratulate you. I do have to say that earlier this morning I talked about the next decade for the access to information agenda, and one of my points was that information is not gender neutral, and we need to bring women into our community a bit more. I congratulate your team as being women, but would also encourage you, as you consider your appeals board in the future, that there might be a voice for a woman on there. But beyond that, beyond my new love of gendered issues, I also think that it's going to be really important how the appeals body functions. So it's great that we have it, but how they work is really going to be important, and how much can actually get to them. So you spoke of the prerogative, really couldn't have been an easier word, the ability for y'all to either give out information, even if it's under exemptions, or in some cases, as you say, withhold it, even though it doesn't fall under an exemption. And I guess one question for me is that ripe for appeal? What exactly within here can make its way to the appeals board, to either the internal or the external? And again, these are all just comments really related to as you move forward in your coming months and years as you continue to move this policy forward. Most immediately, it seems that your challenge, as Chad mentioned, is the implementation. And that, again, is going to be really determinative of the value of this new policy. As you said, General Counsel, it is a paradigm shift, and it is something that will take probably decades, if countries are any example, before either the staff fully understands or your users really believe that this information belongs to them. One of my favorite examples, actually, on the paradigm shift question is how intrinsic this idea of secrecy can be, how embedded in public administrations, for example, in the state level. So we were finding out, for example, in one of the countries that I worked, that inside the office building, they had a fantastic access to information unit. They had tons of information available. It was staffed. Everybody was well-trained. Everyone understood their job. But the users couldn't get through the door because the security guard didn't know that he was now supposed to let people go in order to ask for information. So it's not even just as simple as training those people fully responsible, but really ensuring that everybody, in this case at the bank, understands the new ideas around access to information. I don't want to go through too much of the implementation challenges. I think Chad covered some of them. Certainly, even though the bank is probably one of the best record managers in the world, records is still going to be an area that will merit a lot of focus. And not just how you manage it, but how you then also make it available and in what way you make it available. I know there's been a lot of chatter about translations and forms, and frankly, I think it's a step even before that. It's just, do you have the documents and can you get your hands on them, much less these issues of language. Setting up the procedures for accepting requests and providing information. Chad talked about training and capacity building. That is going to be a never-ending responsibility. We see too often that just as soon as you've trained someone, they move on to another job, and then the training begins again. And so really ensuring that you do have not just a responsible information officer, but a team around her that understands the role. And also that she is getting the support she needs. Chad, I think, talked about this as well. And we talked about it when we talked to the public information officers. When you become an information officer, generally, it doesn't mean you have any less work. You don't get any more pay. You get lots more responsibility, lots more people yelling at you, and not a lot of benefit for it. And so I think, you know, one of the other issues is really identifying how you can incentivize people to be good information officers or good public information communicators. Awareness raising internally and externally. I think we know from experience in Jamaica, for example, the great disappointment the government had when nobody was actually using their new law. And they said, but you told us all these people would come and start asking us, and instead it's just the media who wants to beat us up. And we said, well, yeah, but you haven't done anything to raise awareness, so nobody knows you actually have a new access to information law. So in order to get the benefits from it, there really will need to be wholesale awareness raising, both internally and externally. And then again, this oversight, what is the role of the AI committee? And if it's not to be the oversight mechanism, is there a way to develop a unit who can really oversee and support your implementers? Finally, I just want to remind us all that transparency is a verb. And if it's not, it should be. It's something active, and we need to continue to develop processes and procedures and to do those in a very transparent way. And I think, again, the bank was great in its consultation about the policies. It's been very open in sharing the documents as they're being developed. One area I think that you're still developing is this appeals mechanism. And as you mentioned, there hasn't been a meeting yet, but as you start to develop the role of the appeals body and how they'll function, how often they'll meet, will there be a secretariat, all the specifics, I encourage you to do that in the most open and transparent way possible, particularly because that's going to be the body that in some ways will determine how the trust people have in the system. I think putting the independent appeals body in was a massive step forward, but ensuring that people have confidence in that appeals body will depend very much on the transparency with which it now begins to function. And ultimately, as Chad also mentioned, the goal, as we talked about earlier, is to ensure that the information is reaching the people. And it seems to me that with this new policy and with its proper implementation and its effective enforcement, we really will see that paradigm shift soon in the countries in which you're working, and that your development aid will go to change the lives of the people you care, we all care about most. So again, I congratulate you in all of the work you guys have done. This has been a mountainous task, and we wish you the best. And please, just from our perspective, want you to know that we support the World Bank in your efforts to take on this incredible challenge.
Well, thank you for your comments, Laura. And the audience wants to thank you as well, as they did this morning. Before I turn it back over to Anne-Marie, one of your comments, I think, compels me in candor to acknowledge something on behalf of the United States, and that is, although we say, yes, we had a Freedom of Information Act here in 1966, we were only 200 years behind Sweden. And some number of decades behind Finland, which broke off from Sweden, things didn't really move actively and significantly, very significantly at least, for almost another decade. Our law did not take effect until July 4, 1967. And I think it's fair to say that during that early period, which was one of tremendous upheaval and culture change, initial culture change within federal government agencies, it wasn't until the Watergate era in 1974, the 74 amendments, the time that the FOIA was amended heavily and the Privacy Act was enacted, which didn't take effect until 75 and then really didn't kick in almost to 76, 77. My point is that for the first decade here in the United States, we didn't have anything nearly resembling what we had later on. It's easy to forget that. It's easy to forget how difficult it is to get things rolling like that. And people in the United States will say, hey, it's not that hard. You know, we've been doing it for 40 years or so. Well, it is hard. And I think our own experience here stands as testament to that. Even if those were the dark era days or the dark ages, so to speak, it does take time. And I think anyone who doesn't acknowledge that is just not being realistic. So with that sort of segue, I'll ask Anne-Marie if she has any further thoughts that she has, particularly in light of what the panel, other panel members have said, and maybe we can have some dialogue back and forth, as well as some questions from the audience.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you, both of you, for your good words. It's quite encouraging, and I will probably, given that I've only 15 minutes left, I'm not going to answer all of your questions, but I'd be very much ready to answer some if you aside of the meeting or in another venue maybe someday. But I'm trying to be selective here. I take a broader I'll take as a broad question what you asked, what you said about training, about staff awareness, et cetera, et cetera. I believe that, it's no mystery, and it's not decrying the bank, it's saying that it's a bureaucracy, it's 10,000 people, and although it is, in my opinion, a very committed and hardworking and effective bureaucracy, it is a bureaucracy. And there is, I'm myself a bureaucrat, I come from a government, and we all know that there is this tendency, no bureaucracy, so tendency to secrecy, which is triggered by a lot of elements in the culture, including the difficulty for an individual in that big system to decide on his or her own that he or she has the authority to make that call, which is to disclose a document, and hence the tendency to retain for the fear of being blamed for having released something that shouldn't have released because there was something that was confidential in it or whatever reason. So this is the hard part. But we are dedicating at present a lot of resources to training. We have an online training course that has been made compulsory for all staff. They have to take it before December 15th. There is a lot also of training sessions that are being organized, and we're working hard on it. But we know that it will take time. We totally agree with you.
On the, I'm sure Bob Zelig would have been very happy to for your acknowledgement of his support to the AI policy. Let me just tell you that I can't certainly testify that he's been extremely supportive. He's really pushed for it very actively. Our goal now is to make it mainstream so much that we wouldn't depend on another president to be supportive as well. Because if the next president has to be supportive as much as President Zelig has been, then we're in trouble. Then we're not doing the job well. On the sister institutions and the other IFIs and your call for the bank to take a leadership role here, I believe you will understand that we are very happy to show the, to lead and show to show the path and to break that path. But certainly our sister institutions may be interested in looking at our policy, but they need to make their own policy. We can only encourage them and reassure them that this is not the end of the world, that we can make it, and that all hell will not break loose the day you open the access to information policy. We're working a lot with countries that do not have an access to information policy or that don't or don't have a good access to information policy or technical assistance. His activities are very active in this area. Many areas of governance, but access to information policy is part of that, which is one of the reasons why we shifted, by the way, because some people said that we are not doing what we were advocating in some of our countries. So now that we're in line with our advice, we can be even more proactive. Now let me get to some questions that were more specific and maybe more more directed at the public of lawyers that we have here. On the exemptions, yes, we may need in the future to narrow them down, make them more specific. I think we're open to it. Right now, I think we need to start implementing this and learn as we are doing it. My experience, from my experience in my own country, is that you start with something pretty broad, and then as the specific cases appear, as you have to deal with them, you progressively realize that you can make those categories a bit narrower. That it's in part due to the fact that when you design the policy, it is extremely difficult to envisage all of the cases possible. So you make a broad category in order to be safe and to cover the cases that you know, you, the documents that you know you do not want to disclose. But then as you learn, you can improve the system, and I think we're pretty much open to that. And I think that the, both the Access to Information Committee, as it learns, and the Appeals Board can help us narrowing and focusing better. About redaction, there may not be a specific paragraph in the policy about redaction of documents, but it's not forbidden either. And if you look, for instance, at paragraph 20 on documents that are country-specific operational documents are routinely discussed with a member country, I had not prepared anything. I looked very, very quickly at the policy, and you will see that we will, when we have a request for disclosure of a document, that is, we go to the country and ask them if there is anything confidential for them in that document, and then we say the bank, as it considers appropriate, makes adjustments to the document to address the matters of concern to the country borrower. So the document does contemplate redaction when necessary. And I don't believe that it is forbidden, even if it is not stated that clearly here. On the attitude saying it's in the web, it's on the website, go find it. I take the point. Let me use that opportunity to mention to our audience that if they want more specifics, it's on the website. And they should go find it.
Just coincidentally, right? Total coincidence.
It's on welfare.org/WBAccess. go find it. about unsupported requests and service fees. Here, of course, on service fees, I think it's up to us to be reasonable here and to make sound judgments. But we also have a fiduciary obligation. Remember, we're a public institution. We, Botvita, at least our concessional funds are money that is given to us by our donors, or it is funds coming from the interest paid by our borrowers, which are developing countries. We have to make sound and reasonable use of those resources. And we, and you know that these features exist in all access to information policies, I think. We want to be protected against some reasonable requests. It does not mean, which means, for instance, someone comes to us and says, I want to read all the country assistance strategies that you've written since 1948 or since even 1960. We want to be able to say, no, sorry. But this would be an unreasonable call on our resources, on our time and resources, and we cannot accept it. Or if it's a request that is too vague, or if it's a request that would oblige us to do in-depth research in our archives, basically we're ready to provide information provided we have it or we can retrieve it in a reasonable time. That's the protection that we have here, but I believe that so far at least we've shown that we were ready to implement the policy in a very open manner and to do what we can. These provisions are just there to give us the protection we need in case we have really unreasonable. Unsupported, I don't think in our mind means that the request that the person requesting information has to tell us why. Certainly not. But it's really requests that are not specific enough, and we don't exactly know what the people are looking for, which could lead us to spend way too much time retrieving the information.
Is it possible that the word supported as meant or intended by the bank is not quite what the average person might think the word supported means, that there might be sort of a gap, a semantic one there?
I hope there is not, but in any case, if that, we may have to tweak a little bit the policy after some time of implementation, and that maybe I noted the misunderstanding here, so that's something that we'll remember.
Because I imagine the bank would not want the public to think that the standard is more rigid than the bank really intends it to be.
Oh, certainly. On the Access to Information Committee and the Appeals Board role, the Access to Information Committee, as I mentioned, is a management committee. So it is the body that we've created in order to both manage the first stage of appeals, which is to give the bank, before we go to the appeals board, give the bank a chance at a higher level or at a more cross, a trans-institutional level, make a judgment, a business judgment, on whether we should release a document which is otherwise not releasable, or etc., but which also is has in fact taken that responsibility to monitor the implementation. So I think because they make judgments or decisions on requests that we have, they're very well placed to see how things are unfolding and to monitor implementation. So this is that double role, but it's not judiciary yet. It's really the business decision that is made on the first. We call that appeal, but it's really a request that has been denied or not answered. The person can go to that committee, and before we get judiciary, then we get to a semi-judicial process, and we can quickly make a decision and solve the issue. Regarding the appeals board, of course, there we are at a level which is more quasi-judicial, and since we have three independent persons, how they will work is still to be determined, and I think that will be the object of their first meeting. They do have a secretariat, which is the Access to Information Unit, which serves also as the secretariat to the Access to Information Committee, which is at present staffed with three people, one secretary and two, one H level and one G level people, which is fairly highly qualified people here. One of them, but the head of the unit is here. It's Lisa, whom you may know, Lisa Louis, who's also been the main author of that, one of the authors within the bank of the policy, and who is one of the most knowledgeable persons about the policy in the bank. The appeals board, by the way, is not in charge of, will not examine appeals directed at our decisions on the exemptions, which is if a document is clearly under the exemptions and we decide as a business decision to disclose it anyway, or to the contrary, if a document is open and we decided not to disclose it because we exert that capacity that we have, that authority that we gave ourselves not to disclose in case, then this is final. This is really a business judgment that the bank makes, and we hope that it will remain very, very exceptional. The appeals board has more legal role in the sense that it's about the interpretation of the policy, and it is a case where we disagree with the requester on whether the document is disclosable or not, and whether we unreasonably refused or denied a request, or whether we misinterpreted the policy. This is what the appeals board is there for. And that's it. And on the records, yes, as a knowledge, we may have a problem sometimes retrieving the documents, but I think we've been very open with the civil society organizations on this. But it's work in progress. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anne-Marie. A quick note about time. We do have some time flexibility because only three of the five panel members on the next panel are here. And one of them is a look of consternation on his face because he knows there are, in fact, only three panel members, and each of them is here. But we do have some time flexibility built into the schedule, and I know we might have some questions from the audience, even conceivably from other members of the panel. I just want to ask one very brief one. This is maybe more of a yes-no. And I'm still in deposition interrogation mode from yesterday. I don't want to treat you like the former Attorney General, but I think this is maybe a quick yes-no question. Do you think that given the step that the World Bank has taken, that even beyond the sister organizations that were spoken of earlier, it's even conceivable that the bank would be in a position, you use the words encourage and reassure, to influence the UN to finally take that step, which would, I don't want to say that that would be more significant than the World Bank, but it would indeed be a significant step. And I just wonder now if the time has come where it's actually realistic, atop what the World Bank has done, for people to think that the UN might be taking that step in a major way as well.
As you can imagine, it is difficult for the bank to encourage other international organizations to do something or not to do something. Mm-hmm. Our legitimacy to do it is limited. We can just testify that it's doable and that we're happy with that policy. But encouraging them or pushing them or advocating in that direction might be more the role of the CSOs than the World Banks.
We're on it.
Yeah. But I wouldn't want to pass judgment on the UN policy here because really the World Bank is not in their capacity to do it.
Well, I see there's a quick question over here.
Thank you very much. I thought those very interesting presentations. And frankly, the start of the policy is inspirational, the wording about the intention and the purpose and what you're trying to achieve. So congratulations as well. I have three questions, which I'll try and merge into one to make it sound like it's only one question. I'd like to learn a little bit more about your implementation plan. You said that there was no release of the implementation plan for the, or maybe I'm misconstruing that. Is there an implementation plan for this policy? And will it be made publicly available? I think A lot of countries can learn from your experience in implementing this type of policy. My experience so far has been that, you know, it's just recently that countries are releasing their implementation plans for these types of policies. And it has been very helpful. I helped implement a policy in Cayman Islands, and it was very useful to learn and look at the implementation plans of other countries. We looked at Scotland, very useful implementation plan that was made available to the public. And some other countries are now starting to release their implementation plans. It teaches you a lot about the fundamental administrative structures that you need to put in place to make sure that this kind of policy really has results. So my first question would be about the implementation plan, and is there any plan available or will be made available on how this policy will be streamlined? The second question relates to something which I don't think I read. A number of countries very recently, including India, have included things like sanctions in their law for public officials who hide information or refuse to disclose information or take longer than the required period under the law to actually respond to requesters. And I know my colleagues in India have said that that's one of the real reasons why their law has been so successful, because there's this sanction. Yeah. I myself don't believe you should only have sanctions for public officials. You perhaps should also have incentives. But has the bank thought of incentive schemes or sanction schemes if members destroy documents not to release them? It has happened in other countries. Who knows? It could happen in a bank situation. And the third question really relates more to what you were talking about in terms of costs. A number of countries put provisions in their laws that say that if you're indigent or in poverty, you can request a waiver. We've recently done research at the World Resources Institute that shows that one of the major barriers for the poor to access information is costs first. And then secondly is communication channels. How are you going to deal with the issue of really taking this information to the people that it matters? It is an issue of, you know, removing that barrier of cost for a number of them, providing the documents not on a website, but actually in the hands of peoples or orally through public meetings. Is there a part of the policy that will deal with its implementation in country? And hopefully that's one question in three. Thanks.
On the implementation plan, yes, I confirm that there is an implementation plan, which in fact involves several units in the bank. Again, it's of the IT people, external communications, legal, I mean, a number of general services, a number of units. I suppose that information is on the website. So I'm going to say go get it again.
Lisa, for the webcast audience, could you just grab the mic that's right nearby or stand up? That should be on and available for people there. If you push the button, I think.
So what I simply said was
or
that.
Or if you grab the other mic for which the button is already pushed and has been functioning with certainty.
What I simply said was that the staff handbook on implementation of the policy has been made public, and it is on the bank's website, its access information website. And there you will see what we are expecting of staff and what documents are being routinely disclosed. So that should certainly help in telling the public what they can find out there. If I can just quickly answer
the sanctions,
issue of sanctions. We don't have any sanctions written into the policy. Of course, if we understand that staff is not making documents available to us for the purpose of public disclosure, we would take the normal remedies of following up with staff and the HR remedies that we have available to us, in terms of basically them not performing their jobs. So we do take this very seriously.
Yes, and I certainly believe that if it happened that the staff destroyed documents in order not to release them, that would be misconduct, and that could be sanctionable just under the regular staff rules. But we don't have a set of specific sanctions for that. On the cost of access, I didn't mention that along with the new access to information policy, we have a new translation policy. The bank has been blamed a lot for not translating enough. So we are striving to improve that and translate many more documents than we used to. That's the main issue for our 187 countries now. And it's the fact that most of our documents are in English or in two or three other languages, but not that many. So translating has been the main issue so far. And then a lot rests with the country offices and their capacity as they prepare their projects and that, as they implement them to make the information available to the concerned people. We do also have a consultation policy. We do our best to reach out to the concerned, to all stakeholders and to the concerned people when we prepare and implement our projects. But it's a permanent challenge, as you can imagine.
Okay, I think we do have time, some time for one more question. The lady who's been waiting patiently behind that microphone there.
What are, would you say, the top two or three common myths about this policy? And you have a captive audience here, so we're here to listen
was
to you.
Was that common myths?
Yes.
M-Y-T-H-S.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I didn't get the question.
What are two or three top, in your words, myths about this policy?
Myths?
Or misperceptions, perhaps.
Misperceptions.
Beliefs
myths.
That are incorrect.
Correct. And then you have a captive audience here, so we're here to listen to you dispel them.
It's possible, and I don't want to pre-commit what you do, possible the redaction is one of them that you've already covered.
The redaction is one of them. I realized that we have this problem with the, how do you say, undocumented or the requests that are unsupported.
Unsupported. Yes.
We must be careful with that, I believe. Well, there must also be the perception out there that we are not yet completely open. I mean, we've not yet, although we have worked a lot with CSOs here, we've done a lot to publicize what we were doing. We have 187 countries to reach. And the image of the bank may not be that of an extremely open institution yet. In all countries, so we do have to work on this and to make known that the bank is now probably at least on this in this respect one maybe the most open international institution.
Well, I would dare say that in response to that last question as well, there is certainly less misperception now than there might have been on anything just by virtue of you having appeared here like this and brought your staff members, and it's been to the benefit of the public in general and to good perception, not misperception, and also to the collaboration on government secrecy here at American University, Washington College of Law. So I hope everyone will join me in thanking you and your fellow panel members for what you did. And I'm sorry we had an hour and 15 minutes allocated, and we took, I guess, an hour and 25 minutes. But I can see the next three panel members sort of giving me that look. So what we're going to try to do is without much of a break, we're just going to shift quickly into our last panel of the day because that's something that is very significant as well. So if everyone could sort of stand up and take a stretch break, we'll say goodbye to this panel and we'll bring on the next one.